In this part of Focus 580, we will be exploring some of the history of testosterone, synthetic testosterone, and its growing and sometimes hidden influence in our culture over the past 70 years. Synthetic testosterone was first produced in 1935, and from that time, virtually to this, it has promised, at least some people would say it has promised, restored youth, recharged sexual potency, and enhanced athletic ability. But, of course, it also raises a lot of significant questions, particularly the question of how it is and where it is we draw that line between something that is legitimate medical therapy and something that qualifies as performance enhancement. Our guest for the program this morning is John Hoberman. He's the author of a recently published book that explores some of this territory. The title of his book is Testosterone Dreams, Rejuvenation, Aphrodisia, Doping. The book is published by the University of California Press. He has written a number of books that look at athletics and performance enhancement. Among his books, Darwin's Athletes, How Sport Has Damaged Black America and Preserved the Myth of Race. That's his most recent, I believe, published in 1997. Others include Mortal Engines, The Science of Performance and the Dehumanization of Sport, The Olympic Crisis, Sport Politics and the Moral Order, and Sport and Political Ideology. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are certainly welcome as we continue through this hour of the show. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But if you'd like to call in, have a question, have a comment, you're certainly welcome to do that. If you're in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. Around Illinois, Indiana, as a matter of fact, if you'd be listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Hoberman, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Maybe two sort of basic points just to talk about a little bit at the beginning here, and then we can get into these questions in somewhat greater depth. I guess one of the things that should be said is that virtually ever since testosterone was first synthesized, 1935, almost from the start, as has been the case with other things over time, it was said, at least by some people, to be a kind of all-purpose tonic, a virtual miracle cure, something that was recognized very soon as being a potential muscle builder, but also something that for older men would restore their sexual potency, would make them more productive, more energetic. I think in the book you make the argument that it was some people would have represented it as the Viagra of its day. From that time and still today, people still argue for testosterone in that same kind of way.
Yeah, that's true. The early publicity for the drug in the 1940s focused more on its potential as an aphrodisiac. Mm-hmm. The discovery that this was a really potent muscle builder, especially in conjunction with training, was more a discovery of the 1950s. The steroid epidemic in elite sport takes off during the 1960s, and half a century later, we've got the most recent version of it. This is a drug, that is to say, the androgenic drugs, the testosterone, other synthetic anabolic steroid derivatives, are demonstrating a real power to appeal to a variety of groups of people who find them useful and attractive, as well as legitimately therapeutic in certain medical senses. This is a drug with charisma.
And that's, I guess, I don't know if this is oversimplifying the point, but just so people make sure they see the connection, the kind of performance-enhancing drugs that are so much at issue today in athletics, the anabolic steroids, essentially what they are is not exactly a synthetic testosterone, but what happens is when you take them and you put them into your body, what happens is they get made into testosterone. So in a sense, that's what you're doing. It's a way to augment or to supplement the testosterone that your body would naturally produce. But both men and women do naturally produce it.
Right. Men producing a lot more. Than women, which makes these male hormone drugs more potent in female athletes, relatively speaking, than they are in males.
Hmm. The other sort of general point, other than the fact that for going back some time now, people have been boosting testosterone, and there has been interest in it for these various reasons. I guess the other thing that's a fairly consistent sort of a story, again, going back to the time that it was first synthetic testosterone first produced, was that there was this recognition, at least on some people's parts, that there could be a very lucrative market for this product.
Yeah, I noticed, for example, that Business Week magazine reported in 1945 that synthetic testosterone was potentially a very lucrative drug. One of the developments that I describe in the book is, in a sense, something that did not happen. In 1945, a popular science journalist named Paul de Kruijf published a book called The Male Hormone. It is reviewed in Newsweek. It's reviewed in Time magazine. He is a well-known figure. It is an attempt to mainstream synthetic testosterone drugs for very large numbers of aging males. He was 55 when the book was published in 1945. And he was a great believer in it. What the book argues is that despite de Kruijf's publicity, despite the effort during the early 1940s in particular by pharmaceutical companies to persuade doctors that this was a male menopause drug whose time had come, American society was so sexually conservative in its mores that this simply could not ignite as a mass therapy, as aphrodisia for the masses. And what I argue in the book is that we had to wait half a century between the mid-40s and the mid-90s for the sexual mores of American society to change to the point that the idea of providing a hormone aphrodisiac, if you will, to very large numbers of people, especially aging people, in the mid-90s, this catches on, and you start seeing cover stories on testosterone, such as the one that Newsweek published for the first time in 1996. And for the past decade, this is a drug that has been taking off. Medical prescriptions, for example, have almost tripled between 1999 and last year.
We have a caller here, someone on a cell phone, so I will not make them wait. We'll bring him into the conversation on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask a question, and then I'll hang up at the answer.
Okay.
Recent biological studies indicate that testosterone has a profound effect on the development of the fetus, particularly in terms of gender differences. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, and specifically about how that translates into an effect on babies that are born either to mothers who are taking testosterone or to fathers who took it. And I don't mean in a Lamarckian sense of testosterone being passed, but in terms of fundamental changes in the DNA and sperm. And because I think there's a potential, I don't know, and that's what I'm asking, danger for people to take testosterone in the effect it's going to have on the children they bear later in life. And I'll hang up. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Is the question clear?
Yes, it is. I cannot offer much expertise in response to this particular question, but one thing I have seen is that when, for example, you have a male and female twins, and I believe that in that situation, some testosterone in the inside the mother, inside that sac, can influence to some extent the, say, the muscular development of the female infant in such a way as to make that a more athletic girl than would otherwise have been the case. As a matter of fact, I can recall from my own children's childhood a pair of twins who demonstrated, both of them, male and female, extraordinary athletic ability. So I don't doubt that there are intrauterine effects on fetuses by testosterone, or especially a supernormal level of testosterone. As a matter of fact, one of the sort of pseudo-medical proposals that I describe in the book is a suggestion some 20, 30 years ago by a German scientist that testosterone injections be given to mothers in order, believe it or not, to prevent the development of homosexuality in male fetuses. The idea being that that homosexuality was in effect a male hormone deficiency that could be remedied by supplementary testosterone intrauterinely delivered. Now, this is a proposal that has not gone anywhere, but it, in fact, it harkens back to atrocious experiments in concentration camps, for example, that involved giving supplementary testosterone in the early 1940s to homosexuals in a concentration camp on account of the Nazis' war against homosexuality and their version of the dream that homosexuality was a male hormone deficiency that could be cured. But I cannot comment on the specific effects of giving extra testosterone, say, to a father who is going to produce a child with a woman. That doesn't sound to me, especially since there wouldn't seem to be any gene line transmission of traits there, that would be particularly effective. I don't doubt that putting extra testosterone inside a mother who is bearing one or more fetuses could very likely affect the development of both children, but I cannot comment on that with medical expertise. Hmm.
Is it not also the case that here in the United States there were times when there were physicians that advocated using testosterone as a treatment, we'll put that in quotes, as a treatment for homosexuality?
Yes. This is the 1940s. And these are reputable medical journal articles. I describe them in the book. What they discover, of course, is that administering extra testosterone to the male homosexual is not going to produce a reversal of gender orientation. Quite to the contrary, one of the almost comic observations that appear in one or more of these articles is that all it's going to do is to intensify the sexual desire towards other males, because that happens to be that person's orientation.
Let's talk with someone else. This is a caller here locally in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, just a technical clarification. I believe during the setup, David, that you said that the book is about synthetic testosterone.
Yes.
And my question is, by the term synthetic testosterone, is it meant testosterone that is identical to what the body produces, only it's made in a laboratory, or are we talking about other molecules that act like or are intended to act like natural testosterone, but that are different from what the body produces?
Yeah, that's a good question. In fact, the answer is both. It deals with the synthesis of the testosterone molecule, the basic testosterone molecule, and the anabolic steroid derivatives, which represent, in effect, innovations on modifications of the basic testosterone molecule that is identified as such. I've seen one scientific article that said, hypothetically, you could have, you know, given the way that you could modify the basic structure of the molecule with certain groups at certain points on the on that ring, something up to maybe 600 possible variations on the testosterone molecule, which is one of the reasons that we read in the paper about designer steroids, about potentially undetectable anabolic steroid drugs that are assumed by experts to be out there, because the detection instruments have not been calibrated to detect molecules of that precise mass. So, in effect, we're dealing with a basic testosterone molecule and a derivative of that molecule that are modified for at least a couple of major purposes. Number one, you can try to magnify the so-called anabolic or protein-slash-muscle-building effect of the drug, or you can engineer the molecule in such a way as to make it more or less potent as an androgenic drug, which is to say as a sex hormone. Other modifications can make it either shorter or longer lasting or persisting in the body, which is of interest to athletes who want to use this stuff and not be detected. They will stop using. They will say, well, in order not to be tested positive at a certain event, or if I'm randomly tested, I've got to stop using the drug, let it wash out of my system X number of days or weeks before testing may occur.
Okay. I guess there are at least two main arenas of use of these substances. One, the sports performance-enhancing one that you were just discussing, and the other, a treatment, in quotes or not, for older people. And my lay reading suggests that the use of forms of testosterone that are not identical to what's produced by the body is associated with all sorts of unwanted side effects, more than those that are met by using testosterone that's identical to what's in the body. And so it would seem worthwhile in the discussion to make clear which is being talked about at any given time.
Yeah, I agree. There is a long list of side effects that have gotten a lot of attention lately. The anti-steroid campaign that has now been federalized and, in effect, taken over by the Office of National Drug Control Policy that runs the decades-old war on drugs has been emphasizing a long list of possible medical hazards. One of the problems is that there is a lot of confusion in the coverage that we read, and it's not easily resolved confusion regarding exactly how dangerous these drugs are. One of the problems is that drugs with a 65-year history of legitimate medical uses have been caught in the crossfire of a war on drugs that tends not to distinguish between all sorts of different kinds of drugs, recreational drugs so-called versus performance-enhancing drugs so-called, some of which, such as testosterone and steroids, can have psychogenic effects, can in some individuals have profound mood-altering effects, steroid rage being the most famous of them. But my point is that we have an unprecedented public discussion of androgenic drugs in the media these days, fueled, of course, by the Balco baseball scandal. And one of the casualties of this debate is a really reasoned and careful assessment of how dangerous the drugs are. I mean, this is just in effect, a sociological point that has to do with this contest between what I would call the demonizing of drugs, which have a number of legitimate medical uses, as opposed to the arguments that you will hear from, you know, the bodybuilding community, so-called, and various steroid advocates, that the potential dangers of the drugs have been greatly exaggerated. We're still working this out in the public discussion.
A final comment, especially where the legitimate medical uses are concerned, one tends to hear a lot more about the synthetic forms that are different from that produced by the body than about actual so-called bioidentical testosterone, because the synthetic forms can be patented and sold for a lot more money.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies, as we noted, have been interested in these drugs ever since about 1940, which you look in a medical journal like Endocrinology or the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology, and you will see full-page ads from two or three countries, companies that were producing. Well, in those days, the synthetics that were being promoted in the journals were testosterone propionate and methyltestosterone, which was administered orally and I guess still is. But in any case, for 65 years now, you can look back and see the pharmaceutical companies trying to establish a variety of markets for these drugs, and only in the past 10 years or so have they been getting traction and watching the anti-aging market expand in a rather dramatic way, which accounts for much of the increase in the number of legal prescriptions written, which as of last year was just over 2 million.
And for listeners who might be interested, it's worth observing that natural testosterone is available.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
You can get it at the pharmacy if you've got a doctor's prescription, or, of course, the Internet is now a drug market, among other things.
Well, I guess I don't know how much further I want to carry this point, because we're getting perhaps more into medical issues than maybe we should. But I guess now, in my mind, I'm a little confused. We know that there are a number of problematic side effects associated with these anabolic steroids that we're talking about that have been so much of an issue now and used by athletes and by other people who are interested in bodybuilding, essentially. And is it the case, though, that synthetic testosterone, if indeed what we're talking about is something that is like that's produced by the body in all respects except that it's made in a laboratory, that does not have the same negative side effects that the anabolic steroids do?
No, it can't. The issue is one of dosing. And the long-standing debate that has developed over the past 65 years since these drugs went into sort of primitive clinical experimentation in the late 30s, around 1940, was what do you do with the individual whose testosterone level is normal as opposed to subnormal? And for a long time, and including today, there is a kind of a medical consensus that you do not want to boost the individual above the so-called normal level. Now, this can be difficult to establish as a single number, and in fact, it doesn't. The male testosterone level rises and falls in the course of a 24-hour day. But what you see in the medical literature, say, over this entire period of time, is a lot of caution with regard to raising testosterone levels above what is roughly defined as normal. The principal medical concern at this point is the possibility that you're going to promote the growth of an extant prostate cancer that is going to feed off of the extra testosterone. In fact, reducing testosterone levels, even castration, is one surgical therapy for prostate cancer, because the assumption is that these bad cancer cells are, in effect, being driven by testosterone that's in circulation. But I mean, the latest version of this, by the way, is the Procter & Gamble initiative to put on the market a testosterone patch intended for women suffering from a so-called loss of sexual desire because of a surgical menopause. They've had their ovaries removed. And that means that their testosterone level is going to drop. The assumption is if we restore it, it's going to do something positive for sexual desire. But that is apparently the case, at least in some people. But here again, in the year 2004, 2005, one encounters this cautionary maxim that, number one, you don't want to boost it above normal. Number two, and this we've heard for years, is that there's really no point, that you're just wasting your money. That one, in other words, one of the most significant of the biological ideas that has been in play since these drugs have been available for clinical use is there any reason to boost the testosterone level of the human organism beyond what it, quote-unquote, naturally produces in the absence of, say, a testicular cancer that's going to remove the testicles medically and thereby require a synthetic testosterone replacement therapy. So this has been a big issue now for more than half a century, and it's still out there as a pharmaceutical company, or in this case, Procter & Gamble, its pharmaceutical arm, attempts to put out that testosterone skin patch for the purpose of purportedly relieving a sexual disorder that is the result of surgery.
Let me introduce again our guest, and I have a caller we'll get right to. John Hoberman is talking with us about his recent book, Testosterone Dreams, Rejuvenation Aphrodisia Doping. That's the subtitle. It is published by the University of California Press. He's on the faculty at University of Texas at Austin, and he has written a number of books that have to do with this particular issue one way or another, particularly looking at athletics and performance enhancement. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, our caller changed their mind. They're on our line number one. I'll ask you a question. One of the things that I wanted to ask just to satisfy my curiosity here in the course of the conversation is how it is that this connects with your academic background and interests, because you are, in fact, a professor in the Department of Germanic Studies at UT Austin, and it is very clear that there has been this consistent interest that you have had if you look at the titles of the other books that you have written. How did you get interested in writing about this particular subject?
Well, I sort of converted to sports studies as my major field of research about 30 years ago, and have published a series of books that attempt to look at the sports world as a model of the larger world out there, or to study the sports world for the purpose of understanding politics, the uses of political ideology, the Olympic movement as a model of international organizations. I've learned a tremendous amount about how international organizations function by studying the Olympic movement, for example. Then, about 20 years ago, I became very interested in the whole idea of doping, performance enhancement that is judged to be legitimate in some forms, illegitimate in other forms, and I must say I simply have been unable to let go of this topic. I think the reason for that is that I see the sports doping issues that our society is currently wrestling with in an unprecedented way as a kind of a stalking horse for bigger and, in fact, even more important biomedical developments that are going to dominate the 21st century so far as what kinds of human organisms are going to be considered to be desirable, even tolerable? What about human/animal hybridization, which has begun in certain forms in laboratories? In other words, what what is a human being? Is there a basic standard necessary definition of what a human being is such that this creature should or should not be modified by a variety of technologies? And the technology that I've spent my time studying primarily is hormone therapies. But what you learn in the course of looking into the background of hormone doping in sports is that it is just one aspect of a much larger picture, that the medical use of these drugs, as I mentioned, goes back about 65 years. The athletic use of these drugs only goes back about 50 years. They don't become really influential in modern sport as we know it until the 60s or so. And now we've got a real problem, not simply because there are very significant numbers of elite athletes who are ready, willing, and able to use these drugs to boost their performances, but also because they appeal to a much greater number of people who are outside the world of elite sport. And these developments just keep pouring out of our news reports, the most recent being having to do with teenage girls and even pre-teenage girls, where you have kids, middle school kids, high school kids, who are females, and anabolic steroid use is estimated on the order of 5 to 7%. The purpose is not, in most cases, to boost athletic performance on high school sports teams. It is rather personal appearance. What kind of a body are you going to be able to display on the beach? These kids grow up in a society where you cannot escape the advertising for erectile dysfunction drugs. You cannot escape the advertising for Botox and other cosmetic agents that are supposed to improve a woman's appearance. Our kids are marinating in an enormous mass of advertising that advertisements that deliver the message that the human body, its capacity for sexual experience, its capacity for athletic self-expression, all of these capacities are modifiable through pharmaceutical products. The fact that it is not as simple as that gets lost, and the result is a growing number of children who assume that enhancement drugs have a legitimate role to play in modern life. I saw a report from a French research outfit, an important French research outfit, reported that a majority of six-year-old children in France now assume that the elite athlete needs drugs in order to perform adequately. In the country that invented the Tour de France, the most drug-soaked athletic event in the history of the world, it is hardly surprising that children are coming away with this particular value system.
In the book, you make the point that in the period just after World War II, there were people who felt that testosterone, synthetic testosterone, might be poised to take off as a mass therapy for aging men. As I said a little earlier, the phrase you used, some people thought of it as the Viagra of its day, that it had potential for as an aphrodisiac for men and for women, and also that there were some people that thought it could be used as a treatment for homosexuality. And which has largely been discredited. But the other kinds of uses for testosterone, the other kinds of enhancements, it didn't take off right then, but it did eventually. It took a little while. The question I guess I'm interested in having you talk about is the role to which initially the hesitance, the unease of the medical community, most doctors, how it is that turned around. I think that perhaps one of the reasons that it did not take off in the 1940s was that doctors were just really unsure about it. and that perhaps the reason that we have now seen the kind of testosterone boom that we started seeing perhaps in the 90s and perhaps even more so if you look at popular culture and how it's written about, say, beginning in 2000, that the reason things perhaps changed is that doctors changed their mind and became much more willing to write prescriptions for these things for their patients.
I would say that that's an accurate depiction of the last half century up to a point. Hmm. But I would emphasize a couple of points. First of all, I don't think that the credit or discredit or whatever for this revolutionary development in attitudes towards these drugs, that in 1995, roughly speaking, they are an acceptable mainstream aphrodisiac for aging people in particular, whereas in 1945 that was not the case. I would not point primarily to doctors changing their minds. I would point primarily to a series of enormous social developments that made doctors change their mind and made doctors adapt to patient expectations that, of course, have a lot of relevance to how much money the physician is going to make, whether that patient is satisfied with what he or she is getting from the physician. When you read, for example, the letters that physicians wrote to the Journal of the American Medical Association back in the 40s, even the 50s, what you see is a socially conservative attitude toward human sexuality, toward human sexual self-expression. What I found in a number of these letters, and I did not find any sort of evidence to suggest that this is not valuable anecdotal evidence, is that the idea that aging people were entitled to a lifetime of sexual gratification more or less did not exist half a century ago. That would be 55, certainly did not exist in 1945. What you see is doctors saying, look, you know, you've had the sexual career that you've had, you have had children, and since the human organism deteriorates after the age of 40 or so, what you're facing here is not some kind of syndrome or disorder. What you're facing is the normal aging process, so-called. And now this, we're talking, you know, 50, 60 years ago. The idea that Mr. and Mrs. Smith, who, and it was very important when doctors even thought about improving people's sex lives, it was assumed that these were married people, that this was going to be sex in the context of marriage. This is one of the aspects of what I'm calling social conservatism. That the idea that a physician would be ambitious on behalf of improving the sex lives of people over 40 or 50, let alone 60 or 70, that really would have counted as an eccentricity at this point. But then you get the 60s. You get the influence of the contraceptive pill. You get the human potential movement of the 1960s. In the 1970s, you get a very powerful feminist movement that dates in Western societies, I think, since about the early 70s or so. That's how I would date it. You have very powerful social movements, in other words, that are creating a context in which people are going to think about human potential in new ways, and frankly, more demanding ways. This is going to create an enormous market. It's going to create an appetite for certain kinds of human fulfillment that once upon a time had been imagined to be the preserve of a rather small number of people. Now this is, in effect, a mass movement. And in that sense, I feel that social movements such as the sexual revolution, so-called, feminism, the spread of the psychotherapeutic ethos to vastly larger numbers of people than were getting the benefits of this sort of treatment back in the 40s and the 50s, this created a context in which physicians respond to patients who march in with needs and demands in a way that patients simply did not 50 years ago.
You were talking a little bit earlier about your concerns about the direction that we might be moving as a society, that we are becoming more tolerant and indeed more embracing of the notion of performance enhancement over a broad range of people and activities, and encouraging people to think past talking about athletes to thinking about all of the kinds of things that we might do, particularly using pharmaceuticals and supplements and things that are available over the counter and so forth, that when you think about it, actually come under the heading of performance enhancement. We may not think about it that way, but it is. What exactly is wrong with that? And is this a matter of something that we should be concerned of overall, or is this a matter of degree, and we could make the argument that maybe too much is bad, but a little is not so bad?
That's an extremely important question, and I guess I would come down on the side of those who would say that it is a matter of degree. I've spent 20 years working on athletic doping, among other things, and my own personal disposition is that I'm not interested in watching. I mean, I've followed track and field ever since I was a kid. That was a long time ago. You know, I was a runner for a long, long time. I'm not interested in what I would define as drug-assisted performances. That is simply not what I want out of watching a track meet, for example. But this is a question of values and cultural choices. There are apparently lots of people who want to see a lot of home runs regardless of what it takes, and there are survey data to back up that particular observation regarding the feelings Americans have about the propriety or impropriety of performance-enhancing drugs used by professional athletes like Major League Baseball players. There's quite a bit of tolerance for performance enhancement of that kind. But this is really the key question, and a very, very difficult question. Okay, so I spend lots of time observing the drug habits and values of, say, elite athletes. What if an elite athlete, this doesn't happen, unfortunately, but it should, turns around and says, all right, professor, what would you do if you woke up one day and were presented with the following situation? Either you take this kind of psychoactive drug, or your competitors in the intellectual business are going to surge past you because they will be taking this drug. They will be able to think faster. They'll be able to think deeper. Their publication rate is going to soar, and yours is going to lag. What if the outside observer, somebody like me, were in effect put in the predicament of a shot putter? This is a great example because everybody with any sense knows that anabolic steroids produce much longer shot puts than people who aren't on those drugs. There's a huge documentation for this, so it's a good example. For the last 30, 40 years, you couldn't function at the top of the shot putting game without using steroids. You could say the same thing about weightlifting. It's just they're open secrets. So these are people in a fix. What if your gift in life is an athletic gift, and you're looking at the competition take drugs and simply run away from you? What if now that predicament is your predicament? You are not a physical performer. You are a mental/intellectual performer. This is a very discomforting question that I think people like me have got to confront and be honest about. What is too little? What is too much? What about the U.S. Air Force policy of essentially requiring certain combat pilots who are going to be encountering a lot of fatigue to take amphetamine? I've seen the document these guys have to sign. And there's real pressure in there to take the drug. Now, some physicians would say, oh, my goodness, you don't want to give amphetamine to a pilot. You might have hallucinations, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, there were American pilots in Afghanistan who killed four Canadians in 2001, and their amphetamine consumption wound up at their court-martial as an issue. What if you can give drugs? The military is very interested in psycho-boosting of soldiers, of perhaps giving them a new prescription drug, an anti-narcoleptic drug called modafinil. It's sold as Provigil. What if you can keep these soldiers awake for 3 days, 4 days, 7 days, so that their vulnerability to enemy fire at night when they are handicapped by fatigue is, what if you can relieve that with a drug? Do you really want those military personnel to show up at the poor mother's door and say, ma'am, your son died in combat, but at least he died drug-free? I mean, this is actually a plausible scenario in the world we're living in. But who needs drugs to survive, for example? The air surgeon of the U.S. Air Force published a kind of an apologia for the amphetamines they were giving pilots in 1944, saying to the American public, you know, we know that these drugs have a bad social reputation, but my God, we've got to give them to these pilots in order to keep them alive. This seems to me legitimate performance enhancement. I don't think people want to die drug-free. They want to live their lives. I mean, it's an extreme case, but I think it's a useful case study in the kind of thinking that one must apply situation to situation. What about the stimulant/amphetamine epidemic that is currently raging on American college campuses, with lots of kids getting their hands on Ritalin, on Adderall, in order not simply to stay up at night, which you can do with caffeine, but what you see in this increasing number of reports, there was a show about this on our local news just the other night, and there's quite a bit in print. What the students say is that not only I can stay up at night, I can focus in a way I could not before. I simply don't want to go back to getting B's drug-free when I can use Adderall that maybe I get from my roommate because he's got an ADD prescription for it. I don't want to get B's drug-free. I want to use the drug and get an A. This predicament, this conundrum about performance enhancement that you brought our attention to is by no means limited to the athletic field. This is going to be an expanding issue, one of the great humanistic problems of the 21st century. And that's why I think it's useful to study athletic doping problems, athletic doping scandals. Where's the value system that can counsel self-restraint credibly to people who may feel that for the purpose of earning a living, whether it is a professional cyclist who's got to get through 2,500 miles of the Tour de France, or whether it's a college kid who is under pressure to raise his grade point average, where is the Archimedean point? Where is that leverage point where we can stand credibly and counsel people to exercise self-restraint vis-a-vis the pharmacological aids that are becoming increasingly available?
We're almost out of time. Very quickly, in about a minute, I am interested just in one small piece of this because of the attention that performance enhancement drugs have gotten lately in sport, and the fact that representatives of professional athletics here in the United States have been in front of Congress. There is this concern, perhaps not so much for those athletes as it is for kids who'd look at them using those drugs, and we have now seen greater use of these kinds of drugs by college-level athletes, by high school-level athletes. Do you think that the fact that it's getting attention now is going to change anything?
I think there are going to be new laws passed by a Congress that demonstrates, I think, a very deficient understanding of the scope of the issues that they've chosen to get involved with. For example, there is a subcommittee chairman in one of these House committees whose name is Cliff Stearns. He's a Republican from Florida. He's the author of the currently proposed, the Drug-Free Sports Act of 2005. This is H.R. 1862. He said, quote, just the other day, professional sports expect world-class performances from their players, and these athletes should be subject to world-class testing standards, unquote. What I think the representative is overlooking is that if you are going to preserve the demand for what he calls world-class performances, then you had better be ready to endure a great deal of doping. The more sensible solution would be to try to recast our sports culture in such a way that you don't have people who are doing everything humanly possible, including using pharmacological aids, to produce these performances, and then say, and we're going to spend millions on gas chromatographs and everything to catch you if you dared to use drugs. In other words, you're creating such an overwhelming incentive to use drugs that it is pointless to say, we expect from you world-class performances, and then we're going to catch any so-called cheaters with world-class detection equipment.
We're going to have to leave it at that. The book, if you'd like to read it, we've talked about Testosterone Dreams. It's published by the University of California Press by our guest, John Hoberman, from the University of Texas, Austin. Professor Hoberman, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.